So that was Tracy Chapman, and of course that was the great song Revolution that she sang and went number one here in 1989. And we are now about to begin our program to look at the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Let's see if I can get my headphones working here. They don't seem to be. There they are. There we go. Nothing like headphones at work. This is much better. So we are joined here in the studio by Dr. Carsona Whitehead. Kate Whitehead, of course, is Assistant Professor of Communications and an Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland. She's written a new book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil Rights Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which we'll be talking to her about soon. And this is a book that Henry Louis Gates says is one of the most important new books written about in black history. So congratulations for
Thank
that
you
as
so
well.
Much. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, good to have you here as always. John Nichols joins us by phone, the Washington correspondent for The Nation, co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. John, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It is a great pleasure to be with you.
And Joe R. Hicks is with us. He's a member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Network, Vice President of Community Advocates, Inc., a privately funded Los Angeles-based political think tank, analyst and commentator for PJTV.com, where you host the Hicks File and the Minority Report. And Joe Hicks, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Really good to be with you, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888, with your reflections on this day, this anniversary, July the 2nd, of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This is also the anniversary of the Mississippi Freedom Summer, the time when Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were killed, but a dozen, more than two dozen others were killed as well in the South in that summer. Fighting, most of those being black folks whose names we do not know or even recognize. This was the summer of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which we'll be talking about more in August, where the great Fannie Lou Hamer led that party in Mississippi, demanding it be seated instead of the Mississippi delegation. And Fannie Lou Hamer was this incredible, people say uneducated, that means she didn't have a degree, but she was this brilliant leader of the civil rights movement in the South. And one of the mothers of the civil rights movement in the South. So this day has a lot to talk about, what happened in 1964, what was going on, what was being churned up. So you have thoughts on that and where we are today with it all, 410-319-8888. And there's a significance, John Nichols, to this day when this vote took place in Congress after 57 days of a filibuster by Southern senators. The bill, the Civil Rights Act, that outlawed discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, and national origin, was passed in the U.S. Senate by 73-27 vote and in the House by 289-126 in a coalition of Northern Democrats and Republicans. Bipartisanship. Doesn't happen today. Reflect on that a moment.
I will reflect on it. I think it's perhaps one of the most important legacies of the civil rights era and one of the most tragic aftermaths. In 1964, there was obviously action at the executive level. The President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, a Southerner who had certainly in much of his life accepted segregation and the legacy of Jim Crow, was determined to pass civil rights legislation. But he could not possibly have done that with his own party. In fact, if he had merely had to rely on Democrats, if Republicans had been opposed, civil rights legislation would not have gotten through the United States Senate by any measure, and it frankly would have had a hard time in the House because of the Southern segregationists who controlled key committees. And so there's something remarkable that happened. Johnson worked closely with very, very conservative Republicans, people like Charles Halleck, who was the minority leader in the House, and with many moderate Republicans. The one thing to pull together here is that overwhelmingly the Republican Party was on board and was very actively engaged with this legacy initiative of the Party of Lincoln. And the critical opponents of it, the key foes, were Democrats, Southern Democrats. Now, the fascinating thing about this whole process, and the one thing I'll bring home for folks listening in Maryland, is that in addition to Thurgood Marshall, if you want to talk about folks from Maryland who played an absolutely essential role in civil rights, you have to talk about Senator Mac Mathias, a member of the House at the time.
Right.
Mathias, John Lindsay, and Congressman Bill McCullough of Ohio did a project in 1963 where they essentially developed their own civil rights legislation, and they put it forward. It was so embarrassing to the Northern Democratic leadership that this caused John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson to up their game, to become far more aggressive, as well as other Democrats. So it can fairly be said that much of the sense of immediacy and the pressure for meaningful civil rights legislation can be traced to Republicans. The final tragedy of the story, though, is that while the Republicans were so critical in making it happen, there was an almost immediate aftermath that saw a diminution of this great work. 2 weeks after the Civil Rights Act was passed, the Republicans nominated one of the handful of Republican senators who had opposed the Civil Rights Act, Barry Goldwater, for president of the United States. 2 months after the act was passed, they accepted into their membership one of the leaders of the filibuster against the act, Strom Thurmond. And over the ensuing years, people like Thomas Kuchel, the great senator from California who was a Republican floor manager for civil rights, as well as Clifford Case from New Jersey, as well as Jake Javits from New York, as well as John Lindsay himself in a New York mayoral primary, were all defeated in Republican primaries. And you saw this tragic transformation of the party of Lincoln that had done so much to advance civil rights into a party that now, Todd Purdom, the great historian of the Civil Rights Act, suggests would not, in all likelihood, have played that same bipartisan role to pass this bill.
John, thanks for that really erudite history. That meant a lot to kind of lay this out and where we're going to go in terms of where we are today. But let me turn to a Republican member of this panel. At least I'm assuming you're Republican. Joe Hicks, before we go to Kay Whitehead.
Yeah, Mark. That was very helpful sort of history. And I think, you know, where we're obviously transitioning to kind of, well, what does that mean today, looking back 50 years, you know, the sweep of history and the plight of where black folk were in 1964, and for people that were alive and are around and remember those days, and I'm actually old enough to remember, you know, what it was like, even though I'm talking to you from Los Angeles, not exactly the center of the struggle, as it were. But, you know, in 64, black folk were catching hell all throughout the South. And I think there would be an agreement among all three of us and all four of us, frankly, that was a extremely important piece of legislation that the civil rights movement desperately wanted passed. And the meaning of it, I think, is critical in terms of where we find ourselves today. I also have to say that, you know, a lot of people think that the civil rights, the 64 Civil Rights Act, in fact, was the one thing that happened that then began to change the course of American history. I would argue that America had been changing. Black GIs coming back from World War I, you know, as well as World War II, were simply no longer willing to go back to their homes in the South and to put up with the kinds of things that were taking place there. Also, you know, white Americans were beginning to change because the steady drumbeat of the message of rights and justice was beginning to have some impact. So the nation was beginning to change. By the time we had the freedom rides and the other kind of agitation and protest and struggle, the 64 Civil Rights Act was in many ways a culmination of all of that. But I think that, you know, looking forward to where we are today, that was, in fact, the one event that I think caused many white Americans to look in the mirror at themselves and say, how am I thinking about my fellow Americans who have dark skin? What are my belief systems? It's clear that white supremacy had been the operative way of thinking about their interactions with the rest of the people who lived in this country, and obviously this nation's always been fairly diverse. It's clearly more so now than it's ever been. But I think we've made incredible changes. when we sing that song, "We Have Overcome," or "We Shall Overcome," I think by and large, Black Americans have overcome, and the nation's overcome, many of the kinds of things that that were troubling, horrific, difficult. And I think now we need to, there are clearly battles yet to be fought. And I think those are the discussions that, in particular, Black Americans need to be having in communities all across this nation. What is our narrative about ourselves? How do we see ourselves in this country? Because the old narrative, I think, perhaps does not work as well as we would like. So that's just kind of my opening shot, and I think I'm very pleased to be on the show, and you know, and particularly with this set of other guests that you have on. They're clearly you know, people I'd like to be in a discussion with this morning.
Kay Whitehead, well, Dr. Kay Whitehead.
I just want to add to that. The guest before me talked about how Black people were catching flack all across the nation leading up to the 64 Civil Rights Act. I think it's important when we talk about this to talk about what that means. What do we mean by catching flack? What had happened in the country, at least in that last year, which I call the most pivotal year in the Civil Rights Movement, which was 1963. I mean, you think about the March on Washington. You think about the Birmingham campaign, and I would encourage people to go and take a look at the PBS documentary that focuses on the impact of children being used in that movement. You think about Kennedy's response. I mean, his civil rights talk came after the Children's Crusade when he began to introduce this legislation. You think about the bombing of the Birmingham church and Dr. King's release of the letter from a Birmingham jail, and then the assassination of Kennedy. That was 1963. So going into 64, you had the history kind of building towards this pivotal moment. So one of the guests laid out, you know, what was happening across the political landscape. The social landscape had been changing. Black people had been catching a lot of flack, and they were at a point where something had to happen. So when Johnson pushed towards putting this legislation in place, using the memory and the legacy and the assassination of Kennedy, the mourning that people had to really make this happen, it was trying to change this landscape. And I wonder, looking back 50 years, how much has been changed? We have seen quite a few advances. I would not dispute that. Major advances have happened socially and politically. I wonder economically if we have really moved forward like we need to move. I think about Dr. King when he said roughly 3 weeks before he was assassinated that we need to move beyond this idea of political equality and talk about economic equality. What is the point of being able to sit at the lunchroom counter if you can't even afford the meal? So there's still pieces of this act that we need to think about and think about how they're still changing. What are we trying to become as a nation? What are we looking to become in terms of our racial and political and social and economic history, our legacy, and where do we go forward from here? So I'd really like to explore those kind of ideas today.
I think that, you know, there are a lot of things in this, and I think about the 64 Civil Rights Act and that period of time and where some of us were at that moment in the civil rights movement in the early 60s of this country. And you have to kind of beg a couple of questions. We always hear this line, "We've come so far, but we have so far to go." Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you all think that means. You know, it's something that people say very glibly, I think, in the world. And I think about, you know, that one of the things that happened right after the Civil Rights Act, that things began to explode in the South. Yeah, the bill was passed. It was one of the most important pieces of legislation ever passed in this country. But things began to really explode. More murders took place in the South. Mm-hmm. We had yet to go across the Pettus Bridge. That was coming up a year later. Assassinations were going to happen starting in 65. Murders were still taking place throughout the South. Fannie Lou Hamer was severely beaten and almost died from a police beating, but kept on struggling to organize sharecroppers to vote. People were risking their lives to organize people to vote in the South. So, but it seemed to me that up to that point, in many ways, at least for most of white America, there was a mythology about who we were as a nation. That mythology got torn asunder. And I think in some ways we're still trying to figure out, Kay Whitehead, and then go to John Nichols, how to put that back together and how to define who we are. What comes next? I mean, this is what I'm trying to say is that I think the 60s tore America apart, and we're still trying to figure out how to put ourselves back together.
Let me take a shot at this and then hear the other wise comments from our other commentators. We're talking about the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Right.
A year from from now we'll talk about the Voting Rights Act
of 1965.
And we will see them in their historical, you know, significance. But we also have to, as the other guests have so well done, put this in context. Congress and the White House never, ever leads. They always follow.
True.
And yes. So the Civil Rights Act, as passed in 1964, was a codification in many senses of where the body politic nationally had come, where we had moved to. And there was an unfortunate reality there. That progression had really come into the heads of a lot of political players in Washington. We should not underestimate that. There were very, very conservative, very moderate folks who decided to embrace the Civil Rights Act. They did so because of what they had seen in 1963. And I would especially highlight the assassination of Medgar Evers. I think that incidents of that kind caused even very conservative folks at the national level in the political and media elites to say, hold it, we've got to do something. We have to legislatively and legally act here.
I would add to that.
Okay, if I just... If
oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
Because I know what you'll say, probably be so much wiser than my conclusion here. but just to offer my rough attempt here and to say the problem with that moment is that that just as political leaders saw the necessity to act, political leaders also saw opportunities politically to reshape the politics of the country in the coming era. And unfortunately, both the Democratic and the Republican parties, I think, in the aftermath of 1964, 1965, missed the opportunity to create a sort of a one-nation leadership that would then, you know, connect with this big change that was going on. Many countries struggle with moments like this. Many countries fail. So it's not some huge condemnation of a particular group of people or even a particular country. But it is to say that we today have not completed the civil rights arc, that arc of history. And I think one of the key reasons that it has not been completed is because there really has been a political reshuffling that has seen, and I will bluntly emphasize, a Southern strategy on the part of one political party that I think has not or did not fully embrace its own legacy, and I think did, frankly, a lot of damage to our politics.
We're going to come right back with Kay Whitehead and her thoughts. She was about to say something as well, and Joe Hicks and you at 410-319-8888. We'll be taking your calls as we come back from this next part of our show. As we break at the half hour, we're going out with My Imagination by the Great Temptations. Paul Williams of the Temps, born on this day in 1940. My Imagination.
Each day through my window I watch her as she passes by. I say to myself, you're such a lucky guy.
That's Walking with Mr. Lee by Lee Allen and his great band, Lee Allen, born on this day in 1926. So as we go through our musical breaks with some of the great music that's associated with this day of July the 2nd, which is also the day that we're talking about here on the program, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, what it means then, what it means now. And we're going to, in a few minutes, talk about whether it could even be passed in today's United States Congress, and also what we do need to wrestle with here as a result of that still in 2014. 50 years later. The number here is 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. We are here. You just heard John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation, co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And you can go to our website, steinershow.org, and see the series of conversations we have with John, his co-author, about that book. Joe Hicks is a member of Project 21 Black Leadership Network. And Dr. Kay Whitehead is professor at Loyola University Maryland and author of Notes from a Color Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. And Kay, you were about to say what?
There were a couple of points that the guests had made, and you had said before the break, that I just wanted to respond to. One is you talked about how the 1960s had torn America asunder and that we have spent time trying to pull ourselves back together. I think there are a lot of moments in American history where we have been torn asunder and we have done the work. I think about American enslavement. I think about the Civil War. I think about incidents that have happened all over the world that have impacted our nation and how we have done the work to kind of repair ourselves and to figure out where we're going so that we can move forward. I think the 1960s did tear us asunder. I don't think we're still torn asunder. I think we're dealing with new issues now that are not separating us, not necessarily along racial lines. I think this idea of these economic divisions are something that we seriously have to deal with that have nothing to do with the color of your skin. It's really about what is in your pocket and the type of jobs and opportunities that you have. The second thing I wanted to respond to is the guest mentioned before the break that we missed that moment after the Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act to become one nation. I am not sure if one nation is even possible. I kind of shy away from this idea of us coming together as one nation. One of the things about America that's so great is that we do have this diversity in terms of voices, in terms of opinions, in terms of lifestyles. And I'm not sure what one nation would look like. Perhaps one of the best things about us is that we're willing to roll up our sleeves and work towards becoming better. I don't think we will ever get there towards becoming a perfect place, but that we continue to commit ourselves to trying to do things a little bit better today than we did yesterday. Could the 64 Civil Rights Act pass today? I don't think in this Congress, with this House, and with this president. Absolutely not. Does that mean we have to stop trying? No. But it means we need to figure out who do we want to lead us, and can we take the power in our vote to actually legislate change happening on that level so things do not get stuck in the House, in the Senate, with the president, but we can have real change happening. The guest said that the Congress tends to follow as the nation leads. I think at a time that did happen. I'm not sure who's leading the nation at this moment. Who are our leaders who are actually pushing Congress to act? I am not clear on that at this moment.
I'm going to come back in a few minutes and ask John to talk about what one nation means and respond to what you were saying, because I'm curious to see what he says. Joe, I mean, do you think, you honestly think that the Civil Rights Act could pass today in the form that it was in, given the opposition now and the ideology of most of the people who are in the Republican Party, in the Senate, in the House?
I mean, you know, the notion that you've got any majorities in the House or the Senate who don't support civil rights for Black Americans, I think, is fairly ludicrous. It would pass, and you know, and I think that indicates the sweep of change in this country. That racism is a belief system that is a pariah in this nation. You know, and you can see it in the timidity of Republicans. To say things they think will open them up to charges of racism. People scurry from the charge of racism because that is something that is viewed overwhelmingly in this nation to be something that's completely unacceptable. The bigots and racists, frankly, in this nation live at the margins under the rocks of this country. So the notion that any kind of bill that would, I can't even imagine a historical scenario where that would come before a current Congress, but let's just play with this for a while. Bring that same bill that bans race discrimination in this country. The notion that people would not line up to vote for that measure, I think, is nearly unthinkable. But I think you asked a very key kind of question, this notion, and you hear it all the time, and people say it in a very glib kind of way. It gets said from pulpits of Black churches. It gets said from our civil rights leadership. We've come so far, but there's yet so far to go. And I think that needs to be parsed out and teased out. What does that mean when people say that? You know, and when you try to tack that down and say, well, what do you really are saying there? What would you like to see? One of the critical things about leaders like Dr. King and Fannie Lou Hamer and all the greats that have come before us, they fought for very specific kinds of things. You know, we've had these just epic battles in this country for very specific kinds of rights in places like Montgomery and Birmingham and Selma. We've had, obviously, these two monumental and historic legislative wins, victories. Civil Rights Act of 64, we're talking about today, Voting Rights Act of 1964. We've had three decades or more of affirmative action and racial preferences for black folk in this country. We can argue whether that was a good thing or not, but nonetheless, it exists. You know, so the question, you know, is what are the specific kinds of things that we would like to see this nation do? And as the question is posed, what kind of new legislation, what kind of new laws, what kinds of things would we like to see done in very specific kinds of ways? That's where things get a bit sticky. That's why I argue much of, I think, the work that needs to go on isn't the interaction with white America. Yeah, that's important. You know, we need to always try to advance the ball on that. We don't live in a country where we have great race relations. We have good race relations. But I don't think we're this sort of struggle for a utopian nation. And I hear that a bit in what Ms. Whitehead was just saying, that there perhaps is no perfect world. I do think we can be one nation, but we could talk about what that might mean. So, but I think that the discussion needs to be going on in and around America's black communities about what kind of narrative, and I'm coming back to that again because I think it's a critical discussion we need to be having in this nation. You know, people like Eric Holder, other liberals I hear constantly talk about, we need a conversation on race. And I chuckle when I hear that because, you know, we do have this conversation, but usually it is black folks lecturing white people about what you need to do. What we need to do is have a conversation within and among black leadership and black people about how the narrative we tell about ourselves, how do we explain the black experience to other Americans? And it can't any longer, I would argue, in 2014... be defined by victimization, because victimization is what our narrative has been up to this point. What should our new story be? Frankly, because when we tell the story of victimization, people look at that with incredulity. They go, wait, that, come on. Yeah, seriously? So I think we need to have those serious conversations about how we see ourselves and our place in this nation and what that new narrative should be. And that could be, I think, a very constructive conversation.
There's so much to say here. Let me try to get two very quick calls in. I want to come back to both notion that we have like 20 minutes left about the notion of this one nation that John and Kay were talking about. But I also want to come back to this whole notion of the idea of what victimization means and what other people talk about in terms of the institutional racism that exists in this country and what's the reality. So these are truly important issues. Each could take a whole hour's discussion or more, but let me try to get them in here today and ask you all to kind of really get to the point as we do these things so we can get to both those. Let's get a very quick calls here. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How you doing this morning?
Good.
So, you know, I forget the name of the guest that just finished talking, and he stole some of my thunder. I agree with him. I generally agree with what he said about the victimization. And one of the things that really bothers me that, you know, I don't like racism. I don't like anybody would exploit anybody, whatever your skin color is. But the bottom line, sometimes, and maybe even I've used it, but sometimes the word racism is used too frequently. You know, I'm a conservative. I don't know awful lot of conservatives that wouldn't support certain bills or certain legislations would also support others. But the assumption is if they don't support this bill, that they're a bigot or a racist. That's nonsense. I get tired of it. It bores the hell out of me. One last thing. Send some positive messages out. Mentoring for the black community instead of always, it's always about what happened in the past. Think of the future.
Thank you. And let's go to 410-319-8888. Let's talk to Louise here for a moment. Louise, you're on the air. Hi, Louise. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I want to talk about this so-called change that has occurred in the United States in as regard to Freedom Summer and what is going on today in Detroit. In Freedom Summer, we as African Americans who dare to even register to vote were retaliated against by the white supremacists by cutting off their food supply. Today in Detroit, their water is being cut off. And not only that, but the difference is that their children are being taken away. And there is nobody there to help them. At least at Freedom Summer, you had Dick Gregory, who chartered a plane to provide food. Where's the Dick Gregory's of today? Where are they? Floyd Mayweather, I understand, dropped $30,000 in a strip club, and another basketball player spent $500,000 in the casino. That money could be used to help the people in Detroit. Where are the leaders and the religious leaders talking about what's happening there and their children being taken away? And I would like to also address the issue of Malcolm X's role in what happened with the Civil Rights Act, which is what I think that this, Malcolm X's role as far as threatening to go to the UN, which is a tactic the people of Detroit are using now, going to the UN. So I would like those issues to be discussed, if possible.
Okay, let's begin there. Can we just get into the question of the victimization versus the questions of the divide between black and white in America, of perceptions and reality and economics, as well as institutional racism? Kayla, let me let you begin.
I like this idea of exploring what is going to be our narrative, our new narrative, as we go forward. I mean, the guest spoke about how most of the time when you're talking about race, it's usually blacks lecturing whites about what they should do. I would disagree. Black people are having these conversations in and amongst themselves. I mean, I use by way of example this whole idea around the President's Initiative for My Brother's Keeper, that there is a push for the Why We Can't Wait movement for that to include young girls and young women of color, that we're having these conversations, we're looking at how do we shape our new narrative, talking about illiteracy rates and poverty and incarceration numbers and teenage pregnancy and strengthening the black family, moving away from victimization. This is not victimization. It's talking about what the current problems are and how we can address them. We are having these conversations. It's not just about lecturing white people. And I put that in quotations because we're even changing this whole definition of what it means to be white and black in this country, but not just lecturing people about what they should do, but also what I should do to be a part of the change that needs to happen. And I think by saying that we are not doing that, I think you're underestimating the type of groundswell movement that's happening within the black community. It's happening on Twitter. It's happening on Facebook. It's happening in community centers. It's happening in schools. It's happening in universities. We're having these conversations. We're not just lecturing. We're trying to bring about true and effective change by working through the system, not just outside the system, but through the system as effectively as we can.
John, let me ask this question: when you talked about One Nation and Kay kind of questioned what that meant, what could you expound on that just a little bit more?
I'll do my best. The notion of One Nation conservatism is a British concept, also relatively common in Canada. It hasn't crossed to the U.S., and so it's a term that I'd love to see become a part of the U.S. discourse more. And what it suggests is not that everybody gets on the same page and everybody agrees on who they are, where they're going. In fact, I think what Kay's just said is perhaps one of the most vital parts of our whole conversation, this notion that there are deep, important conversations going on all the time that are rarely reported by our media. But in a concept of a one-nation approach, it is that a political party may at times go beyond its sort of grasping for power, its desire merely to win elections, to stand for things that are bigger and better, perhaps, than its past, or perhaps that are reflections of the best of its past. I think one of the great tragedies of contemporary American politics is that there is too little of that. Kay, and I think, in fact, I think this whole conversation has often gone back to this question of where's the leadership? And some of our callers have raised that as well. And this is what I see as very much missing today. In the 1960s, for all of the failures and the collapses of that time, there were many, many figures, African-American, white, Hispanic, Asian-American, who really stepped up and tried to talk about a broad vision of America that was inclusive, that was diverse, but also made sure that everybody had a place at the table. And there were all of those discussions, all of those comments required some measure of sacrifice of immediate political gain, and in fact a restructuring of how you thought about politics, not as building a 51% coalition, just enough votes to get you past the challenge of an election, but this idea of really building out and reaching beyond yourself. And I'll close just by saying, if you read the platforms, particularly the Republican Party in the 1950s and early 1960s, 1956, 1960, they're really remarkable documents. And they're talking about, you know, going someplace big. And I think a lot of Democrats at that time also came into that place. I think now our discourse is so often, at the highest levels, small. It is self-serving. It is hyper-partisan. And it doesn't look for those moments, again, those one-nation moments, where political figures can go beyond themselves. So that's what I'm talking about. And I do think that in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, we saw politics kind of rush back in some of the ugliest and most difficult ways. And I don't think that I don't think we've been well served as a country by that.
So let me pick up on a point here you made and give some quick comments from you all. Again, 410-319-8888, if any of you have any more comments to this. Or you can write us later at steinershow@gmail.com. We're always looking forward to the after-show comments and conversation. Is that when you look at this, I think you're right, John, and what you were describing is what happened at that moment was that America's eyes were opened by a lot of things in those few years before the Civil Rights Act. One was a man named Michael Harrington, who wrote a book called The Other America. Poverty was something we didn't want to talk about in America. That was exposed to America with his book, and we had to you had to address it and wrestle with it and think about it. One of the reasons that John F. Kennedy created VISTA was to kind of his way of addressing that. Whether it was enough or not is not a question. That it was forced to address it because it was opened up by that. The struggles of returning black GIs and the civil rights movement of the 40s and 50s leading to the 60s opened America's eyes to set what segregation had done, what slavery had done to segregation and what America was. And so America did come together in many ways between some Northern Democrats and Republicans then who were a very progressive group that were descended directly from some of the progressives of the 19th century into the 20th century. So it was that commonality. But as you described also, there was this revolt, John, that took place and led to the formation of Dixiecrats becoming part of the very far right of the Republican Party, taking over the party. And that's we have this huge divide. So the divide is economic, but the divide is also racial in America. That's who we are. And so you have this diverse group of people around America. And when John was on the show last and we were talking about voting rights, there were people here talking about what was going on with black folks in Tennessee standing up for Voting Rights Act in the capital of Tennessee getting arrested. And John was describing the folks in Wisconsin who were standing up in the small towns against Citizens United. And there are these things happening, but there is no central focus like there was to end segregation. Maybe that's part of the issue. I'm just laying it out.
Maybe that's one of the problems that we're talking about. I love the way the guest talked about the fact that we don't have these leaders that we had in the 1960s. We also had different type of issues then. I mean, Jim Crow was staring us in the face, so we knew what we were fighting against. It's harder to go into the community and say, what do they need? Do they need bread? Do they need books? Do they need better schools? Do they need shoes? Like, it's harder when you have this disparate number of issues that you have to wrestle with. I've been thinking a lot, and I'm going to continue to think about this idea of one nation. What does that mean? Not the one nation that we saw, you know, when Jim Crow ended, because when you talk about integration, what happened? You lost some of the things that were going on in the black community. You lost the black schools and black businesses. When you talk about, you know, it was integration from only one community into the other community. But are we talking about pulling all these communities together? Can that happen? I mean, who do we need to put in office to make this happen? Do we all even have the same goals anymore? I don't know. I think it's an interesting concept, and I definitely thank John for bringing that idea up. Can we ever be one nation? Or is it the same one nation we've been talking about in this country since we first got here in 1619? What does one nation mean?
Right.
Well, I like John's, I'm really glad he raised it. I mean, it's a very provocative topic about one nation. We could probably spend another whole entire hour, Mark, talking about about that.
We can another day for sure.
Indeed, but see, I think in many ways we are one nation. It's clear there are deep divisions. I mean, there are deep divisions in any modern nation. And it's really interesting. You know, when you think of the parts of the world that have struggled with the kinds of issues that America has, only one other country comes to mind, that's South Africa, that, mm-hmm. that had, we experienced apartheid, South Africa experienced apartheid. They obviously modeled their apartheid system after what they saw happening in this nation. Mm-hmm. Both nations have tried to recover from that and create a nation that had a common, you know, set of, you know, a sort of set of a commonly held notion of language, of values, a whole host of things that make a nation a nation. But in looking at this country, I think, what we've had are people, unless, you know, since we're talking about the Civil Rights Act, you know, black folks, some elements of black folk have chosen to opt out of that. There is this notion that America is something we don't really want to be a part of. It's really, you know, when you look back at the sort of architects of America's civil rights movement, their quest was very simple about the things they wanted and what they wanted to achieve in a sort of moralistic way. They wanted black people to be part of a nation because we've always been here. We've been denied that role in this nation. They wanted us to have all the rights that every other single American had, despite their color of the skin. And Dr. King spoke about that, and many other leadership figures spoke eloquently about that. Mm-hmm. I'm a product of both the civil rights movement and much later the Black Power movement. Yes, I'm a political conservative, so you can kind of see the arc. And in between all that, I was a Marxist-Leninist.
Another conversation.
So you can see the sweep of my personal politics. But it's the break. It was an interesting break, and I saw it because it was there, and I saw it happening when Stokely Carmichael and other leadership figures, the Black Panther Party and others, including me very vocally at that time, were arguing that America owed us something. There was a very powerful piece just written in Atlantic Magazine.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yep, Coates' piece.
Wrote the piece, making yet again the argument that we need reparation. Now, I don't want to disabuse the brother's piece because it was a very well-argued, very powerful piece. It was like, pay me. It was one of the most eloquent pieces I've ever read. Still unconvincing, but a very well-written piece. So there's this break in a lot of black folks' minds about America, this notion that the melting pot, we don't want to melt in because we're different. We've got a different experience. We've got this. There's all kind of excuses about why we don't really want to embrace the notion of America. And that's all part of this narrative that I'm talking about. I think we need to really, really hook that up and begin to have some deep conversation about this.
I'm sorry, Judge, I'm be interrupting like that, but because we only have like 4 minutes left in this conversation, we've covered some interesting territory here, and I'm going to let other guests also kind of have a quick final thought here. And I think what we've raised here, I would like to figure out as I review the show again how to come back to wrestle with these. And I guarantee you, Joe Hicks, when we come back and have Ta-Nehisi back and continue our conversations with reparations on the show and what they mean, that we'll have you on as one of the guests. It'd be interesting to have your perspective in that conversation. But our closing thoughts, John and Kay, and we have literally 4 minutes left. So
very quickly, I would just add that I enjoy the fact that we are having these conversations. Perhaps this is what needs to happen more often, not just on the radio, but in some of these other spaces, because we are trying to figure out a new narrative. And perhaps this new narrative is one that people can only define for themselves. Maybe there's not one central narrative for our nation and definitely for the black community at this moment, but there are individual narratives. What do I want to do for my family? What can I do to move my family and my community by extension to a different position? Maybe if we start there, we can begin to then have this groundswell that lifts up. We can move Congress and the Senate and the President in a different direction. But I think it starts with these conversations on the ground about what type of nation are we looking to live in.
John?
I have loved being on with my two fellow guests and with you, Mark, today, because this is exactly the conversation that America should have. And it should go in a lot of different directions. It should go in unexpected ways. And it should make much bigger demands. The crisis of America is not the people of this country, and it's not, you know, whether some folks opt in or opt out or what they choose. The crisis is that the depth of this conversation does not rise into our politics. And that's what we really have to be thinking about. How in the 21st century do we develop a media and a politics that can reflect this? In some senses, it's happening with social media, and in some senses it is happening with local politics in places like Jackson, Mississippi. But our national politics is a mess, And so, in a sense, we see in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 a moment where we could actually say, wow, you know, for all of our failings, our national politics looked kind of good for a moment there. And I think the best thing that we can do is we reflect back on 1964, back on what happened 50 years ago, is to say, how do we not recreate what was, but how do we shape a new politics, a new discourse that can allow us to again say, wow, you know, maybe we can get our act together. Maybe as a people we can explore and go new places and better places, because that's what this country needs to do.
I want to thank all three of you. It's been a great conversation. John Nichols, thank you so much once again. Washington correspondent for The Nation, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Please go to our website to look at the conversations we have with John and others about that book. Dr. Kay Whitehead, assistant professor of communication, affiliate assistant professor of African and African-American studies at Loyola University of Maryland, who wrote this incredible new book called Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. I'm in the middle of it now, and I can't wait to sit down and talk to her about that book. Joe Hicks is a member of Project 21 Black Leadership Network, Vice President of Community Advocates, Inc., and analyst and commentator for PJTV.com, where he hosts The Hicks File and The Minority Report. Joe, Kay, John, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Looking forward to the next round with the three of you. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to talk to people on the ground in Gaza and Israel about what's going on, as well as in-studio guests. Stay with us.